Good morning. What a privilege it is for me this morning to be able to talk with you on this special day, Mother's Day, day that I always think is a good time to remember our families, the things that happened to us when we were children, and to thank God for the mothers we had. In looking up a little bit of the history of Mother's Day, it's kind of interesting. A man by the name of William Walker, you've probably heard of this before, in 1865, wrote that famous quote, "The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world." And then in 1909, a lady by the name of Anna Jarvis decided that she wanted to honor her mother, and so she was the first one who decided there ought to be a Mother's Day in this country. And finally, not until 1914, President Woodrow Wilson signed a proclamation recognizing Mother's Day for the first time. Every president since that time has agreed, and now it's become kind of set in stone. And it's an appropriate time, isn't it, for mothers? A mother's love and influence are priceless and far-reaching. Have you ever noticed on TV when people win an award like the... what's it called? The Academy, the Oscars, or anything like that, that they almost always say, "Thanks, Mom." And sometimes you see athletes 7 feet tall, 20 feet tall, huge, big men. And when they're there messing around because they've won their game, what do? They mouth the words, "Hi, Mom." You ever notice that? It's Mom. Abraham Lincoln said this, "All that I am and ever hope to be, I owe to my angel mother." This year I was doing albums for my own daughters on their extended family back 7 generations. And I did all of the pictures. It turned out to be 2 albums for each of them, thick albums. And I interviewed each one of my own siblings, and there are 7 of us. And I'm the youngest of 7, so a lot that they know I don't know because I wasn't even born. But I remember interviewing my one brother, and I asked him what he thought of our mother. And he said almost very similar to what Abraham Lincoln said, "All that I've ever accomplished, every moral part of me, everything that makes me a man, everything that I ever was or ever hoped to be, it's because of my mother." What a tribute. Well, I hope that my children will one day be able to say something similar. Maybe after I'm gone. As a therapist, I recognize that not all mothers are perfect. And not all mothers are even outstanding. But it's a rare mother who doesn't try her best to give to her children everything that it's possible. I have rarely seen mothers who deliberately set out to hurt their children. Do they make mistakes? Yes. Are they imperfect? Yes. Do they wish that they could go back and correct it? Yes. But rare is the mother who deliberately tries to hurt her children. I also understand that there are times when it's not easy to feel the love and appreciation that we have for our mothers. Maybe when your family has gone through a divorce and you felt that your parents were being selfish and weren't there for you the way they needed to be. Not all mothers and not all hurts can be washed away or healed with a kiss the way they can when you're children. There are times when our pain is not soothed by our mothers. When your mother was unable to brush your sadness away. Even when a father, however, is neglectful and hurtful, the children look back and say, "But I blame my mother because she didn't protect me." So we have a very high standard for mothers. Mothers are called upon to be everything to their children. And no mother is perfect. Fortunately, studies reveal that mothers don't have to be perfect, that you can grow up to be very emotionally secure and healthy by just having a good enough mother. That's an actual term that's being used today. The kind of therapy that I agree with is called self-psychology. Now, that does not mean selfish psychology. Self means personality or character, and self-psychology deals with the study of the development of the personality. And it's done in the context of family. And what research is showing is that there are certain things that have to happen in a family. There's a certain amount that the mother gives, and there's a certain amount that the father gives, and the tasks are two different ones. And it is an ideal when children are raised in a two-parent family where both parents recognize and understand what their part is. The part of the mother is to give nurturing, to let the children know that she's there for them no matter what. And the role of the father is to be the encourager. Come on, I know you can do that. Come on, Daddy, we'll help you. That sort of a thing. And the child who has that, even though their parents are not perfect, will grow up to be an emotionally healthy person by and large. So mothers do have within their hands the power to soothe our pain, kiss away our hurts, and fill our lonely places. And I believe that God planted in the hearts of mother the ability to love in such a manner because it gives us a picture of the merciful character of our Savior. Does that mean that only mothers can do that? No, because together, mother and father show what the love of Jesus is. Never just mother, never just father, but mother and father together, because God is all of that to us, both mother and father. So it takes both. But this day we're going to be dwelling on what mother does and how she portrays love, because it's the merciful part of God. Jesus in John 13:34 says, "I give you a new commandment that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another." So it kind of behooves us to look at what God's love is like. And so we'll ask the question, what is that love? His love is the kind that gives life. Does that sound like a mother? His is the kind that is prepared to sacrifice his own life for the one that is loved. How many times have you heard of mothers who are willing to jump out in front of a car in order that their child would be saved? We don't even think about our own safety. It's the safety of the children. And we are prepared to sacrifice our own life for our children. In fact, God is a portrayal of that as well, God the Father. When I was a child, I always used to wonder why it was that God sent his son to come and die for us. Why didn't he do it himself? Did you ever wonder that when you were young? And one day, I heard a story. And it was a story of a little boy who had just gotten a new little cart, wagon cart. And he took it outside to go down the hill. And his mother said to him, "Honey, don't go down the hill because it's very dangerous. There are cars at the end of the hill, trucks and buses and everything. And if you go down the hill, you may go out in the street." But he got tired of playing around in his house and in his backyard. So he finally got outside the gate, decided to go down the hill, and all of a sudden got hit with a bus. And his mother heard the sirens coming, and she got panicked. "Don't we do that immediately? We think it's ours." And so she ran outside and ran down the hill, and here was this broken little body. And she kneeled down toward him and grabbed him up, and he was already dead. And she screamed out, "Oh, honey, I loved you so much. I would have easily died for you." And it reminded me of John 3:16. "For God so loved the world that he" what? "He gave his son." And all of a sudden it dawned on me that it was not an easy task for God to send his son. it was more difficult than if he had come himself and done it. Those of you who are mothers and fathers, you know what I'm talking about. For God so loved the world. And that's the kind of love that Jesus has for us and that we have for our children. The kind that's prepared to sacrifice our own lives for the one that's loved. And the kind that says, there is nothing you can do to cause me to turn my back on you. Will I get upset at you? Yeah. Will I get angry sometimes? Yeah. Will I be hurt? Yes. But will I turn my back on you? Never. Jesus doesn't turn his back on us. And I believe that the popularity of Mother's Day in this country is linked to that kind of love. That's the way we think of mothers. Do we always fulfill the goal? No. But it is the goal. You see, what God asks us to do as parents is not just an ideal. This is how mothers are. We read rosy cards and we hear all the flowery texts and we say, wow, who could ever match up to that? Certainly not me. But it is a goal. It's an admonition and a goal to portray God's love to us. I believe that the reason why God gives us the ability to love that way is so that our children are able to see what God's love is like. A mother's love is the kind of love that Jesus admonishes us. It's a symbol of his love to give to one another. A mother's love is a constant reminder of the kind of love that God has for us. If we did not have that kind of love in our presence, how would we ever really know what God's love is like? He gives us a daily understanding of it, both in how we are with our children and how we see our parents being to us. A mother's love, therefore, for her children in its purest form is a symbol of God's love for us. My favorite text in all scripture is found in Deuteronomy 31:8. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Do not be afraid or discouraged. And then it's repeated in Hebrews. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Isn't that a beautiful text? I will never leave you. When I worked in the prison system in California, I worked doing therapy with some of the vilest of men this country has ever produced. Mass murderers, high-risk sex offenders, people who in passion killed one another or sold drugs so that other people will eventually be addicted and therefore die in their addictions. But in almost every case, do you know what the one regret was that they had? I'm so sorry I hurt my mother. Or in the case where the mother wasn't available, I'm so sorry I hurt my grandma because my grandma gave me everything I needed to have. So even though they may not have any remorse for their victims, they feel badly that they've hurt their mother. Isn't that an interesting thought? And in a lot of cases, now there are always the drug mothers who couldn't care less about their children. But in many cases, a lot of those mothers still come and visit their sons in prison and still pray for them. Another portrayal of God's love that we can see in mother's love is his sacrificial love, John 10:14 and 15. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. Mother's love is often sacrificial. I remember stories that my older brothers and sisters told me of the depression time when there was not much, that people had to wait online for different kinds of foods. And my family didn't always have everything they needed. But my mother always made sure that the children were well fed, fruits and vegetables, even though she would sometimes go without meals herself and got very, very thin, but she made sure her children were well fed. That's the kind of sacrifices mothers make for their children. The kids have what they need, and they're blessed to the best of the mother's own ability. My mother also made sure that we went to church school. I remember, this is going to really date me, but the tuition back then, Mr. Davies, was $11 a month per child. That was a lot of money back then. But, you know, my mother did without herself in order that we would be able to go to school, in a church school, because she wanted us to know and love Jesus. She also would sacrifice her time. I remember every morning waking up, and there would be seven outfits hanging up with seven pairs of freshly polished shoes right underneath. She would stay up at night and clean the house and press our clothes and polish our shoes every day so that people always would comment about how clean we always looked. And my mother took pride in sacrificing herself and her time. Did she have time to do that? No. She had seven children. Where did she get the time to wash and press our clothes every night and polish our shoes? But she made time. She sacrificed her time. And because there were seven of us, she always felt like maybe somebody isn't getting everything that they need. So there were 7 days in the week and seven children. And she would randomly choose somebody every single day and whisk us away, maybe just with me alone. And we would go to the ice cream parlor and have an ice cream cone. Or she would take me to the park to play. And during those times, she would get to know us. And each child thought that we were so special and that we were my mother's favorite. She was able to do that with the grandchildren, too. She had 21 grandchildren. And every single one of those children knew in their hearts that they were her favorite. So when she died, we had the dinner at my house there in La Sierra. And all the grandchildren were out in the family room, and I could hear them discussing back and forth who was Nanny's favorite. But my kids didn't say anything. So later on, I said to them, "How come you didn't say anything about you being Nanny's favorite?" They said, "Because we knew." They never had to question it. Nanny made sure that each child in the family knew that they were the most important one to her. I thought, what a gift is that? You know, that even though she was so busy and there were so many of them, yet she took time out for each child individually. That's sacrifice. That's not thinking about yourself and putting your children first. That's the kind of love God has for us. And then he calls to us, John 15:13. Greater love has no man than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. And in the same way, Jesus laid down his life for us in a sacrificial gesture so that we could have salvation. How many mothers have knelt beside the bedside of their sick child, praying that the Lord would transfer that sickness to them? How many mothers have lost their children and have prayed to God that it could have been them instead? Because mothers have that kind of love, that are willing to lay down their lives for their children so that they could go by free. And then there's the forgiveness of Jesus. When we were undeserving, when we didn't even ask for forgiveness, Jesus hung on the cross of Calvary, and what were his last words? "Father, what? Forgive them, for they know not what they do." We were forgiven before we ever were born. And in the same way, our children are under an umbrella of forgiveness. There is nothing that they can do that would cause us to turn our backs on them. There is nothing that they could do that would not be forgiven before it was would even happen. Does that mean you don't get upset? Of course not. Does that mean you don't scold them and you don't correct them? Of course not. That's also the good work of a mother. In the same way that Jesus scolds and corrects us and allows us to walk down the wrong path so that we can learn the right path, parents who are loving will do the same with their children. And then there's the parables of Jesus that portray who he is, the prodigal son, the lost coin, the lost sheep. The prodigal son in particular, he was so sure he was right. Boy, does that sound like any kids you know today? So sure they knew all the answers. And he said to his father, give me my money now. I'm going to go and I'm going to live the way I want to. So the father, like a good father, said, okay, I've tried to warn you. Now you're just going to have to learn the hard way. So he went out and spent his life in riotous living, spending all of his money until he wound up living in a pig pen. And one day he comes to his senses and he says, why am I here in a pig pen when my father's servants live in a magnificent home? Let me go and tell my father, confess to him what I did so that I can be brought back into his fold. And so he goes, prepares his talk to his father, goes back to his home. And who is there waiting with his arms stretched out? Waiting. Every day, we're told, he would go up to the top of the hill and look down over the valley to see if his son was coming. Because a father's love, a parent's love, a mother's love, and Christ's love is like that. Before we even come to our senses, he's out there waiting for us. Before our children ever come to their senses, we're there praying for them that they might see the light, that they will not be lost. I have a brother who was this wonderful man. And he, through a lot of hurt that happened within the church, left the church and later on became what he claimed was an atheist. And he was a brilliant man and he had every argument figured out in the world for why there is no God. My mother never argued with him. But at 92 years old, my last memories of her is this little old 4'10" woman with a little blue nightie on, kneeling by her bed and praying for each one of her children, especially focusing on my oldest brother. She knew his heart. She knew he wasn't a corrupt man. She knew he would give you the shirt off of his back, but she also knew his heart had been wounded. And every day she prayed for him. Every single day of her life, she prayed for him before she went to bed. She died not knowing whether he would ever become a Christian, but putting her faith in the Lord. And then after she died, he was diagnosed with acute leukemia. And in 4 months was gone himself. But before he died, my youngest daughter and I, who lived nearby, would go up to see him every weekend, and we would spend time with him. Do you know what he wanted us to do every single time we were there? He wanted us to lie down on the bed with him because he was unable to get up, one of us on each arm, and he would ask us to sing Christian songs. And every day he would say to me things like, it's too late for me. I've committed the unpardonable sin. And I said, I've let God go. And I would say to him, but God has never let you go. I will never leave you nor forsake you. I've engraved you in the palms of my hands, and I will never let you go. And I would repeat that to him. And I had the opportunity to share the gospel with him, because it's not how he was raised. Back then, the church was very legalistic. And so he did not understand the gospel. So I had the opportunity of sharing that. And before he died, my mother's prayers were answered. It's never too late for our children, is it? It never is too late. And so Jesus' parables remind us of that. And, you know, to give up on your children is never necessary. We can pray, and you do not know the power of the Holy Spirit in answer to a mother's prayers. I remember when Tammy and Monty were pregnant with, or Tammy was pregnant, sorry, were pregnant with Heather. I was still living in Loma Linda, and one day they were very creative in the way that they announced their pregnancies. And one day my daughter and I got an email, and all it was a little pair of booties, a picture of a little pair of booties. No message, nothing. So Tanya and I looked at each other, why'd they send us that? And then all of a sudden the light came on. Oh, she's pregnant! So we called her, and sure enough, she was pregnant with my first grandbaby. I was so excited. I didn't think I was ever going to be a grandma. All my friends, we would all go out to dinner to get together, and they'd be showing me pictures of their little grandkids, and I would go, oh, that's cute, but when am I going to have a grandchild? And so I was excited as could be. She's the only granddaughter, only grandchild that I actually saw being delivered. It's the only child I've ever seen being delivered. So it was an exciting, exciting thing for me. But when they told us that they were going to have a baby, I was excited, and at the same time, I saw in my mind's eye everything. Everything passing through in terms of what she was in for. And I wanted to share something with you that I saw that actually fits how I was feeling. And it goes like this. We're sitting at lunch when my daughter casually mentions that she and her husband are thinking of starting a family. We're taking a survey, she says, half jokingly. Do you think I should have a baby? It will change your life, I say, carefully keeping my tone neutral. I know, she says, no more sleeping in on weekends, no more spontaneous vacations. And mother thought, oh, you don't know what I'm talking about. But that's not what I meant at all. I look at my daughter, trying to decide what to tell her. I want her to know that she will never, I'm sorry, I want her to know what she will never learn in childbirth classes. I want to tell her that the physical wounds of childbearing will heal, but that becoming a mother will leave her with an emotional wound so raw that she will forever be vulnerable. I consider warning her that she will never again read a newspaper without asking, what if that had been my child? That every plane crash, every house fire will haunt her. That when she sees pictures of starving children, she will wonder if anything could be worse than watching your child die. I look at her carefully manicured nails and stylish suit and think that no matter how sophisticated she is, becoming a mother will reduce her to the primitive level of a bear protecting her cub. That an urgent call of mom will cause her to drop a souffle or her best crystal without a moment's hesitation. I feel I should warn her that no matter how many years she has invested in her career, she'll be professionally derailed by motherhood. She might arrange for childcare, but one day she will be going into an important business meeting and she will think of her baby's sweet smell. She will have to use every ounce of her discipline to keep from running home just to make sure her baby is all right. I want my daughter to know that everyday decisions will no longer be routine, that a five-year-old boy's desire to go into the men's room rather than the women's at McDonald's will become a major dilemma for her, that right there, in the midst of clattering trays and screaming children, issues of independence and gender identity will be weighed against the prospect that a child molester may be lurking in that restroom. However decisive she may be at the office, she will second-guess herself constantly as a mother. Looking at my beautiful daughter, I want to assure her that eventually she will shed the pounds of pregnancy, but she'll never feel the same about herself. That her life, now so important, will be of less value to her once she has a child. That she would give it up in a moment to save her offspring, but will also begin to hope for more years, not to accomplish her own dreams, but to watch her child accomplish theirs. I want her to know that a Caesarean scar or shiny stretch marks will become badges of honor. My daughter's relationship with her husband will change, but not in the way she thinks. I wish she could understand how much more you can love a man who is careful to powder the baby or who never hesitates to play with his child. I think she should know that she will fall in love with him again for reasons she would now find very unromantic. I wish my daughter could sense the bond she will feel with women throughout history who have tried to stop prejudice and drunk driving. I hope she will understand why I can think rationally about most issues, but become temporarily insane when I discuss the threat of nuclear war to my children's future. I want to describe to my daughter the exhilaration of seeing your child learn to ride a bike. I want to capture for her the belly laugh of a baby who is touching the soft fur of a dog or a cat for the first time. I want her to taste the joy that is so real it actually hurts. My daughter's quizzical look makes me realize that tears have formed in my eyes. "You'll never regret it," I finally say. Then I reach across the table, squeeze my daughter's hand, and offer a silent prayer for her and for me and for all of the mere mortal women who stumbled their way into this most wonderful of callings, this blessed gift from God, being a mother. Great, isn't it? Did you feel that way when your child got pregnant? I sure did. Then I would like to give a little word to just the mothers. The rest of you can close your ears if you would like to. God calls us to demonstrate in our lives what it is to be a person of love. He calls upon us to do that. That is our duty. That's our job as a mother. The world is calling for women to forsake his way, to make it all about me, to don't worry about being a good mother. The kids are going to survive. What's important is you. But that's not God's way. What's important to God is to be sacrificial in your love, to do what it is that is necessary to do, to make sure that your children are walking in the straight and narrow path of righteousness, that they can see a glimpse of Jesus. Yes, you'll be tired. Yes, you'll go to bed some nights so exhausted. But yes, you will also have the satisfaction as your children grow older to see them educated and strong in the Lord and worshiping him as you taught them to do. What a reward. You see, our work as mothers is to model. What does that mean? Got a little email the other day from one of my best friends, and here's what it said. When you thought I wasn't looking, When you thought I wasn't looking, you posted my very first painting on the refrigerator, and I immediately wanted to paint you another one. When you thought I wasn't looking, I saw you feed a stray cat, and I learned that it was good to be kind to animals. You see, it isn't just what we say, is it? It's what we do. When you thought I wasn't looking, I saw you make my favorite cake for me, and I learned that the little things can be the special things in life. When you thought I wasn't looking, I saw you make a meal and take it to a friend who was sick, And I learned that we all have to help take care of each other. When you thought I wasn't looking, I saw you give of your time and money to help people who had nothing. And I learned that those who have something should give to those who don't. When you thought I wasn't looking, I saw you take care of your house and everyone in it. And I learned we have to take care of what we're given. When you thought I wasn't looking, I saw how you handled your responsibilities, even when you didn't feel good. And I learned that I would have to be responsible when I grew up. When you thought I wasn't looking, I saw tears come from your eyes, and I learned that sometimes things hurt, but it's all right to cry. When you thought I wasn't looking, I saw that you cared, and I wanted to be everything that I could be. When you thought I wasn't looking, I learned most of life's lessons that I need to know to grow up to be a good and productive person. When you thought I wasn't looking, I looked at you, and I wanted to say, thanks for all the things I saw when you thought I wasn't looking. Little eyes see a lot. Mothering is not an easy task. It will draw from you the most difficult of emotions and create the most difficult of decisions for you to make. Keep your girlfriends, women. Keep your girlfriends. Don't expect your husband to fulfill every single need. Women can fill needs for other women that men cannot. It has nothing to do with me thinking men aren't good enough. They are. They're good enough, just like women are good enough. But women need to have women in their lives. So keep your friends. Don't forsake them for your family. And stay in the Word. The Word brings us hope, and it brings us strength. And every day, carve time out of your busy schedule to spend time in the Word. Children are a gift of God and bring us the biggest and greatest joy that we can ever have. But paradoxically, they can bring us the most pain. So that is the reason why we need to stay in the Word and draw our strength from Jesus. Then some word to the children. And we're all children of mothers, aren't we? So this is really for everybody. When's the last time you thanked your mother for what she's done? When is the last time you thought back over your childhood and youth and looked at the sacrifices your own mother made and thanked her for it? When is the time you felt, when's the last time you felt that strong appreciation in your heart for everything she did for you, for all the sacrifices made? And when is the last time you showed that appreciation? And then one more, and that is a word to the husbands. This is not an easy thing for me to say, because I wish I were just speaking to a men's group alone. And one of these days, I would love to be able to have a small talk just for the men. Men in our society are not appreciated the way they need to be. They truly are not appreciated the way they need to be by their families. Men go out every day and work to provide for you and for your children. And women sometimes will complain that they're not home enough. Now, men are thinking, but I can't be home if I'm out providing. And they think that women are being unreasonable when they say, I need you to be home more. But women are right. And we're not here talking about the amount of time that you're home. A reasonable woman knows that you need to go out to work and provide for the family. The problem is not in when you go out to work. The problem is not that you are out providing and then come home and you don't know what to do, the problem is that you don't pitch in when you are home. You see, women are with children all day long. It's not an easy task. I remember when my kids were small thinking, the only language I know how to speak is Childrenese. And it was pretty bad when I got together with my friends and I started, oh, sweetie. I'm like, okay, there's something wrong with this picture. You see, and that's how it is for mothers. So they don't want you to stop working to spend more time with them. What women want is that when you're there, that you're fully there. That your first emotional relationship is with her. Especially those of us who are in the helping professions need to be very careful about that, because women and children both frequently will feel you give all of your best efforts to other people, and then there's nothing left over for me. And I'll tell you, she is not asking for the time as much as she is asking for the emotional involvement when you are there. Too often do I hear people in my office saying things like, he's gone out to work all day. He gets a certain sense of satisfaction from doing that. He gets rewarded. I'm home all day cleaning house, and I'm with the kids, no adult contact. And then he comes home. I make dinner. He sits down and eats it and then sits in front of the television while my work is still going on. That's not fair. It's really not fair. You see, we have a very skewed idea of the text in the New Testament that says, women, submit to your husband. There is a scholar, a Greek and Hebrew scholar within our denomination, that is probably one of the foremost scholars in this area, in any denomination. And his office was right around the corner from mine. So one day, I decided I was going to ask him, what really does that mean? And he gave me literal interpretations directly from the Greek. There are two interpretations for the word submit. One is the way we traditionally think of it, as surrender. The other is meaning a truss. Now, you know what a truss is, don't you? It's the part of the bridge that comes around that supports the bridge. Now, when they were interpreting from the Greek into English, who was doing the interpreting, men or women? Which one do you think that they would want to interpret it as meaning? Which? Surrender. And down through the ages, that's what it's come to mean. But I submit to you that that is a wrong interpretation. We are to surrender only to one person. Who is that? To God, not to our spouses. But should we be a support to them and uphold their hands? Absolutely. The next verse or so talks about how we should also submit to the church. Does that mean that we surrender ourselves to the church? To the members of the church? No, of course not. But do we support them? That's what the church is. A church is a place where we should be able to come and be supported in our Christian growth. It's a trust, a way of upholding one another, to bring strength to one another. And this beautiful doctrine of support is ruined by the concept of surrender. And when it says, men, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, this picture of love that we've been looking at today is the picture that God wants men to see. It's one of sacrificial love. It's one of upholding that person, of giving her strength. It used to be when I was a child, when I was a young person in college, taking psychology, that the philosophy of the day was that everything in the home, the mother was responsible for. If your child turned out to be a schizophrenic, the mother was termed a schizophrenogenic mother. That means the origin of schizophrenia in her child. Now they know that schizophrenia is actually chemical in nature. If your child was an axe murderer, it was the mother's fault. And everything that went on was the mother's fault. The mother took all of the responsibility. She took all of the blame. You might be interested in knowing that more recent studies have absolutely reversed that whole concept. And no longer are men left out in the dark. But rather, what studies reveal today is that the mother is not the pivotal person in the home. The father is. And fathers, the title of this talk is With Mommy in the Family, Happy, Happy Home. Mommy has the potential in her hand to make that home a happy place. But you, men, are the pivotal person that holds the key to that happiness. You can either bless your family with your quality of presence in the home, pitching in, giving help, supporting her, or you can come home and sit there at the tube and do nothing. What happens in the heart of a woman when that happens is to feel very unloved. And if a woman feels unloved by her husband, she cannot give that same kind of love to her children. It's almost like it's a chain. The man loves the woman who loves the children and gives them the patience and the care that they need. When the man is removed from the home, the woman has no support in her love. Do you see what I'm saying? Does that make sense to you? When I worked with the prisoners, they didn't blame their mothers. They blamed their fathers. The father, they said, used to beat me all the time. One told a story about his father who held a 2x4 behind his bedroom door. And when he wanted to discipline the child, he would take the 2x4 out and beat him with that. That harshness of love is not God's way. God wants us to be men. God wants you to be a man in your home, but a man in your home is one who encourages the children. Come on, son. I know you can do that. Come on, daddy's here. I'll show you how. Come on, let's go do it together. That's a man. A man is not one who controls. A man is not one who determines that he is the only right one and that everybody better listen to him. That's a controlling individual, and it's destructive. So if you want a happy home, dads, you hold the key. With mommy in the family, happy, happy home. But only if she's happy in her marriage. The pivotal point out of which children grow is the crucible of the home. And the most important aspect of the home is the marriage. Women need at the core of their beings. It's not a desire, it's not a wish, it is a need. As much as it is a need for us to eat and sleep and drink, women have the need to be cherished by their husbands. That's what my own research was on. What is the gender needs of the family? The husband is to be respected and admired. And women, we need to show respect and admiration to our husbands. The problem is that for most women, they feel that in order to show their husbands love and respect and admiration, they have to be admirable and they have to be respectable. And then they are willing to give it. But it's a circular thing. The more you show your wife cherishing that she is the most important thing to you, that you come home and you're willing to help, you're willing to do things for her, and then when the children are put to bed, then it's your time. But to do it another way, the woman feels like she's being used. She doesn't feel cherished, and then it's very difficult for her to admire you. So we want to have happy homes, but happiness in the home starts with the marriage. And fathers, you are the pivotal point. Love her by being there for her. There's a film out. How many of you have ever seen this film? It's called Johnny Lingo. How many of you have ever seen it? This story takes place in the South Sea Islands, and the way that the man would choose his spouse would be by, and how he valued her, would be based upon the number of cows that he would give for her dowry. And so there was this one woman whose name was Michaela, and Michaela was this rough, a woman who was tomboyish. She liked to spend her time in the trees. She was matted hair. She was just really not attractive at all and not nice either. And Johnny Lingo, the most handsome man in any island in the South Seas, decided that Michaela is the wife he wanted to marry. So the day came for her wedding, and all the old ladies are sitting on their blankets waiting for Johnny Lingo to come with his cows. And they were laughing. Well, I was a 3-cow wife. Well, I was a 2-cow. Well, I was a 4-cow wife. Well, what do you think Michaela's going to be? Oh, she'll probably be a 1/2 cow. Or she'll probably have a dead cow. And nobody thought that she would mean anything at all, especially to Johnny Lingo, this handsome, handsome man. So they were all sitting there gossiping and talking about Michaela and Johnny Lingo. And all of a sudden, they look up over the hill, and here comes Johnny Lingo. Oh, let's see how many cows he has. 1 cow. See, I knew she would only be a 1-cow wife. 2 cows. And look at that, 3 cows. Who would give 3 cows for Michaela? And they watched some more. 4 cows. 5 cows. Never in the history of any of the islands had any woman ever received 5 cows. Michaela, a 5-cow wife? They went away on their honeymoon, and when they came back, he had built a little cottage down by the ocean front. And there was a white settler there who was a trader, and he did a lot of trading with them. And Johnny Lingo went to visit him one day with a beautiful shell that was worth a lot of money, a rare shell. And he goes into his little store and he says, I want to trade in this shell for something beautiful for Michaela. And he says to him, where'd you get that? And they're discussing the value of it. And Johnny Lingo sees this beautiful mirror all carved with shells on it and gold. And he says, I'll buy that. So the white man said, well, why would you want to buy something like that and spend all of your money on Michaela? I mean, there's not a lot you can do to help her. And so he said to the man, come out with me. And just then, Michaela came out of the home, and here was this gorgeous, graceful woman with long, black, shiny hair, beautiful. And he says, who is that? He says, Michaela. What happened to her? And Johnny Lingo tells him his only little wisdom, she was treated like a five-cal wife, and now she looks like a five-cal wife. So men, what will you do? Do you want a half a cow, a dead cow wife? Or do you want a five-cow wife? Gosh, you've got it made in the shade. So there you go. You will produce in your spouse to the degree to which you show her how much she's cherished by you. So here's a word. It's a blessing for all mothers. And it goes like this. This blessing is for all the mothers who have sat up at night with a sick toddler saying, "It's okay, Mom, honey, mommy's here." This blessing is for the mothers who gave birth to the babies that they may never see, and the mothers who took those babies forever to be their own children. This blessing is for all the mothers who attended ball games, recitals, rehearsals, etc., etc., and who said, "I wouldn't have missed it for the world," and who meant it. This blessing is for all the mothers of Kosovo who fled in the night and can't find their children or can't feed their children. Creator God, what makes a good mother anyway? Is it patience, firmness, a soft lap, or is it mothering what is in her heart? Is it the ache she feels when she watches her child disappear down the street, walking to school alone for the very first time? The jolt that takes her from sleep to dread, from bed to crib at 2 a.m. to put her hand on the back of a sleeping baby? The need to flee from wherever she is and hug her child when she hears news of a school shooting, a fire, a car accident, a baby dying? Yes, it is all of those things. So this blessing is for all the mothers who sat down with their children and explained all about making babies, and for all the mothers who wanted to but just couldn't. This blessing is for all the mothers who yell at their kids in the grocery store with frustration and despair. The blessing is for the mothers who show up at work with milk stain on their blouses and diapers in their purse. This blessing is for all the mothers who teach their sons to cook and their daughters to speak up with pride. This blessing is for mothers who put pinwheels, teddy bears, or flowers on their children's graves, and for mothers who sit at the bedsides of their sick children praying for God's healing and for strength to face another minute. This blessing is for mothers whose children have gone astray, who haven't the words to reach them and yet have never put them from their heart. This blessing is for new mothers stumbling through diaper changes and sleep deprivation, and mature mothers learning to let go, for working mothers and stay-at-home mothers, single mothers and married mothers. And this blessing is for all of us who will move beyond sentiment into actions which support mothers and mothering persons in all of their life-giving and life-nurturing roles. Have a happy Mother's Day.